Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act being signed into law. Joining us to talk about the landmark legislation and the challenges people with disabilities still face are Leah Zimmerman, Executive Director of Student Disability Resources at Penn State, and Michael Barrowbay, Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of Literature. Zimmerman and Barrowbay are co-chairs of Penn State's new Disability Access Initiative Working Group. Leah Zimmerman and Michael Barrowbay, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
I think we all probably have an idea of what a disability is or what it means to have one, but there's an actual legal definition for it, right? Leah, could you tell us what it means to have a disability?
Sure. Legally, the definition is actually quite broad under the ADA, like you mentioned, and the Rehabilitation Act. And it's anyone who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. And when we're talking about substantially limits, what we're talking about is a significant restriction in comparison to most people. And when we're talking about the daily living, what it's impacting, it's anything you or I are doing every single day, the major life activities that we do every single day to function or to participate, things like breathing, seeing, hearing, walking, talking, learning, concentrating. It gets into the function of our body. So again, it's really quite broad, and that's to ensure coverage for the widest range of individuals.
So before passage of the ADA in 1990, could an employer or organization legally discriminate against someone with a disability? Michael, you're shaking your head.
I'm nodding, yes. Yeah. Absolutely, it was totally legal. It was left out of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So for 26 years, people with disabilities had none of the workplace protections that other groups with regard to race and gender and sexual orientation had.
So that was a significant change. What do you think brought it on? What prompted that major change?
Everyone knows about the civil rights movement, right? And rightly so. Finally undid, 100 years of neo-Confederate entrenched white supremacy. We still have it, but at least legally. Segregation is no longer legal. Discrimination is no longer legal. But no one really knows, unless you're in the community, where the ADA came from. There wasn't a similarly very public push for it. It was largely behind the scenes activists, like people like Justin Dart, a lifelong Republican and the heir to the Dart drug fortune, and rehabilitation workers and so forth. So it seemed to a lot of people to have come out of nowhere. Now, it didn't come out of nowhere. But it's a sort of a subterranean story.
Leah, was it just the kind of slowly things were able to change?
I think probably to the disability community, it felt very slow. I think that it was a long time coming. And I think it was really initially focused on physical access. So physical barrier removal, that buildings were and facilities were inaccessible. I think we're well removed from that. We still have physical barrier removal, but I think that we're in a different place now. But that was the beginning in trying to just gain access to facilities and spaces.
In fact, the only really notable public events that put disability on the agenda involved disability activists dramatizing their inability to access municipal buildings, like the demonstration in San Francisco in 1977. The Rehabilitation Act had been passed in 73, but the Carter administration wasn't going to enforce it. So activists in the Berkeley area, which is really where disability rights began in the US, they went to San Francisco and literally clogged up stairs and made the building inaccessible. Smart, eh? And the image in the late 80s of activists crawling up the US Capitol steps, that made the point to a lot of people, And but again, that was largely, almost entirely about physical access. Not that that's unimportant, but it made the point that a lot of non-disabled people didn't really get before that.
Yeah, I mean, I think depending on how old you are, that might be what you remember. That's what I remember, is that there was a big push for ramps to go onto sidewalks, for example, to make it accessible to people with wheelchair, or having elevators and not just stairs. But since then, it's really expanded, right? So the push isn't just purely physical disabilities. Talk a little bit about that, how that's expanded, Michael.
There was a parallel thing. It was the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act of 1975, from which my son, who's down the hall, he's now 29, he benefited from that because it gave him access, as a young man, this boy with Down syndrome, to regular classrooms whenever he could match up. whenever that inclusion was appropriate, which was persisted right through the seventh and eighth grade and into French class at high school. Who saw that coming? But the problem is the IDA pretty much cuts out at 21. And as a result, people with intellectual disabilities have something like an 80% unemployment rate today. And when they do work, as Jamie does, he actually has a four-hour-a-week job with the Penn State Press doing cataloging and inventory. He's very, very good at that sort of thing. But mostly we tend to think of people with intellectual disabilities doing, you know, janitorial or menial kind of jobs, if anything at all. So expanding the ADA to cover intellectual disabilities and what used to be called mental illness, but now we prefer a lot of people to use the term psychosocial disabilities, that's a real challenge. And Leah, especially, I think, would can tell you more about how that works on campus. Most of the time, we're talking about students who might be on the autism spectrum, but anyone with or people with learning disabilities, that's a little bit more of a challenge than just building a ramp, but they too are certainly covered by the ADA. So again, for people with intellectual disabilities, the challenge still has been how to extend the promise of the IDEA, which is wildly successful, and carry that beyond the age of 21 into the employment sphere.
Yeah, Leah, have you seen that expand too? So starting out with the passage of the ADA and you have physical disabilities, but now universities are looking at more than that, right?
Absolutely. I think offices like ours, Student Disability Resources, their initial charge was to ensure physical access to campus, to events on campus and classrooms. And now what we've seen is as we've gained access, as we've offered that to our students, what has really emerged are hidden disabilities. So the majority of disability types that we're serving on campus, I'm talking about 85% of those that we're serving in our office are actually hidden. They're not readily apparent. So these are invisible. So that's very different than the structural barrier removal that started the ADA to now it's about attitudinal changes. It's about how to provide access to curriculum that is about tests and how to complete assignments and show mastery of knowledge in a non-traditional way, perhaps.
Can you give an example of one of these hidden disabilities and the challenges someone who has one might face?
Sure. I think Michael has highlighted some of them. He said psychosocial disorders. There's a lot of terms we could use. We often talk about mental health disorders in our office. It could be learning disabilities, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It could be chronic illnesses, so physical health disorders. Two of those that I just mentioned, physical health disorders or chronic illnesses and our mental health disorders, some challenges is that they are episodic. So an individual has a good day and a bad day. They don't necessarily know when it's going to manifest or how they'll feel in any given moment. And so that presents some complexities in terms of how to accommodate and allow them to be to participate in the educational environment, particularly when they're having a flare-up or a bad day. So how do we accommodate that to make sure that they can experience the most success possible?
Do you encounter or have either of you seen resistance to that? Because as you said, it could be episodic. If someone has severe depression, let's say, or another invisible learning disability, and the faculty member or employer might say, well, you seem fine most of the time. Is there skepticism or resistance to accommodating and helping that student make their way through?
Unfortunately, yes, because I think what we're experiencing is oftentimes it's still seeing is believing or seeing is understanding. I don't know how to help you if I can't observe it or if I can't recognize it. I don't know how to appreciate it or to remedy it. I think that the ADA actually accounted for that. The ADA was amended in 2008 because what was happening is that courts were siding in ways that were eliminating coverage, saying, oh, you're using something, some mitigating measure like medicine, for example, that makes you have good days or it makes the bad days stay away longer. So maybe you don't have a disability. And so thankfully the ADA was amended in 2008 to now say, no, we're not going to take into account those mitigating measures. Regardless if something's episodic, you still are considered to have a disability. So I think that's helped in terms of how we look or define disability and who's covered. Now, certainly stigma and bias accompany hidden disabilities, and we know that media likes to sensationalize, I'm sorry to say, I know you're in this industry, but sometimes they like to sensationalize some mental health stories in particular. So that's something that we're constantly combating. And lastly, literature is will tell you, and this seems common sense, if you don't know somebody with a disability or you don't have one yourself, you're less likely to understand it or know how to accommodate it or even believe in its authenticity, I guess. And so we are constantly battling that to try to help people understand that disability is part of the human experience and that it's absolutely part of diversity.
Michael, in a presentation, I think it was made to the Penn State Board of Trustees, you were talking about making accommodations for students with disabilities, taking tests in your class. And then you said you decided that maybe you should just change the approach altogether, that it shouldn't just be about, quote, accommodating the one or two, the students who need that. It sounds like you're saying you want to just kind of come at it from a totally different direction and perspective.
Yeah. Let me back up, though. I'd like to get to that question, but I want to sort of back and fill some of the things that Leah said, even though she's much more familiar with the law than I am. I think she brought up some really, really crucial points. First of all, when it was passed in 1990, it passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. How could that be? You can't even pass something against gum disease today and get bipartisan support in Washington. It was a really interesting confluence where Democrats and liberals thought this will expand the social welfare state. And Republicans and conservatives thought, well, this will decrease people's reliance on government. So that's where the support came from. The Bush administration was completely behind it. But then what happened over the next 20 years, when Leah mentions the amendments to the act in 2008, courts found in favor of defendants about 97% of the time. The courts really did not like extending this to employers. And they found any number of reasons to prevent that from happening. And one of them was a landmark case in 1999, where the court found that if you had easily correctable disabilities, you weren't covered under the ADA. Famously, Antonin Scalia said, "Are you telling me, taking off my glasses, that I have a disability?" And actually, the answer was yes. Without these, I really can't read. I'm an English professor. That means I do have, in fact, a functional disability, an easy one to correct. Walgreens, you know, that's $20. But it does matter. The point is not whether you have an easily correctable disability. The question is, are you disabled in this context, right? In the context of doing this work on this assembly line or doing this work that involves reading or what have you. So I had students come up to me. The first one was in my first year at Penn State. And the way she put it was, I have arthritis in my hands. Right? It was odd enough to be a 20-year-old with arthritis. She felt a little bit of stigma about that, right? And she was worried about taking the final exam, scrawling things for 2 hours in a room. And I said, okay, certainly you can have extra time. Or for that matter, if it's easier to type than to write, I can accommodate that. But I didn't really think about it structurally until a couple of years later, when in the course of a year or two, I had a student with carpal tunnel syndrome, a student with dyslexia, and a student with mild cerebral palsy. Now, going back to invisible disabilities, the student with CP was the only person who presented as disabled. And it brings up a really sometimes ugly dynamic, where if you see someone with cerebral palsy and they have trouble speaking and moving, the ableist assumption is that they may be mentally impaired as well. It's almost never true. So I had a student who's completely capable of doing the work, but not so much of actually writing and taking notes. And I thought to myself, so why exactly do I have students in finals week come into my classroom and scribble for 2 hours? Why don't I do take-home exams? Now, again, I'm not violating any state laws. The exams still take place during finals week, but I give them questions. They take them home. Of course, they can be open book. It's like writing another paper. And my colleagues are like, oh, they can cheat. Yeah, they can also cheat on papers. And it's your job to find that out. Okay, it's not any different from assigning them another paper. It just gives them the time and the resources they might need. It made me think that really final exams in class, there's something wrong with them, frankly. And it's not just the fact that a lot of students today don't do this thing we call handwriting. Certainly cursive, you know, will probably die in our lifetimes. But it's also not an optimal environment for figuring out what they've learned over the course of the past 3-4 months. Much better to let them have the time to take a week if they want to, and you know, really get organize their thoughts. It also, I gotta say, from a professor's perspective, it's pretty clear who spent a lot of time on the take-home exam and who did it in half an hour. What I'm trying to get at is something called universal design, where it changes the playing field for everyone, not just the students with disabilities, while also offering accommodation for the students who need it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. We're talking with Leah Zimmerman, Executive Director of Student Disability Resources at Penn State, and Michael Barabay, Edwin Earle Sparks Professor of Literature. Leah, do you find that faculty are open to that on the whole, or is there still that resistance or skepticism, concern that students might be getting away with something?
I think we'll always have some of that resistance or skepticism, but I think that faculty, they want to help, they want to understand, they want to do the right thing. I don't want to be giving any other impression that faculty are not trying to support our students with disabilities. But we do use what Michael just talked about, universal design for learning, as a way to humanize disability. It's a nice way to talk about, look, by helping a student with a disability, you're actually offering more opportunity to all students. And I think that that's one way that faculty can buy in and maybe eliminate some of that skepticism. You know, the beginning of that was universal design, and curb cuts are a prime example. So if you think about who benefits from a curb cut in a sidewalk to get up on the sidewalk or down onto the street, certainly an individual who uses a wheelchair, but also an individual pushing a stroller or pushing a shopping cart or who has rolling luggage or who's riding a bicycle, you name it. So by adding that entry point, adding that accessible feature, we've now helped the broadest audience possible. And what we've also done is eliminated some of the need for accommodations. Another quick example might be captioning. We know that captioning of videos will help somebody who's deaf or hard of hearing. But if you picture yourself in a busy restaurant or in an airport and you want to see the election results and you can't hear it anymore on the television, you might read what's being said up there. And so again, what was designed to provide accessibility for somebody who might have a disability is helping a wide range of users. So we try to have faculty understand that incorporation in the learning context about how this could help, again, more than just their students with disabilities. And I think that that helps them and sets their mind at ease about what they're really providing and who it's helping.
Do either of you see that happening even more so now? So because of the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of the teaching and learning is going on for students are at home, faculty are at home, and faculty are making accommodations, maybe videotaping their lectures or lessons that students can watch any time. Do you see that continuing over even after we get out of this pandemic, Michael?
I hope so. My wife, Janet Lyon, who founded the Disability Studies minor and co-founded the Disability Studies Reading Group with me, gave an interview about this recently in which she pointed out, and you can go to that interview or it's on the web somewhere, or you can just look at Disability Twitter and you find the number of people who said, you know what, I needed an accommodation to work from home and my employer said it was an undue hardship under the ADA and they couldn't accommodate that. And now everybody's working from home and what, you know? And the same is true. I mean, even though it is in some ways much more difficult to teach purely online, and it's disembodied and it's alienating and so forth, there are aspects of this that can be incorporated into college life from this point on. And certainly, I think we're going to see over the next decade a real rethinking of teleworking. I mean, it's like a sort of large social phenomenon of the joke, you know, could this meeting have been an email? Yeah, it could have been. What the ramifications of that are, I can't tell you. It'll probably affect white collar workers more than first responders, people in the service industries and so forth, who still, you know, including today, have to show up on campus. But it'll take a while to figure out. And I do think that we're gonna have a much more flexible sense of what accommodation means.
Like Michael said, I hope so, especially in the educational arena. Telework is a really interesting one. Having previously worked in a role that provided accommodations to employees at Penn State, I know teleworking was always an interesting issue, but now in the educational area, I think that faculty are recognizing that things like you mentioned, Anne, like recording a lecture and making that available afterward, not just as an accommodation for somebody with a disability, but that's benefiting everybody. Somebody at home who just is having trouble finding a quiet space or separating themselves from their families to find time to study, for example, or who's working a job and has to then get back to that later. So that helps many people. I think also what Michael had talked about, maybe being flexible in the kinds of assessment or evaluation techniques, that it doesn't always have to be an exam, a multiple choice exam or an essay exam. And I think that some faculty are embracing that in terms of how they can be creative in figuring out what content their students really know. And I hope that that continues.
You mentioned people being skeptical, and I want to underline what Leah says. Faculty, by and large, want to help. There are very few curmudgeons among us. It's usually people who are uninformed or who think a student is trying to cut some corners. So, for example, a student comes to you and says, I want to take this physics class. I just can't do the math part because I have a learning disability with regard to math. The ADA doesn't say you get to take physics without math. But things that involve mild accommodations, like I had a student ask a professor, it wasn't in my class, again, the multiple choice tests fry my brain. I have a sort of dyslexia about multiple choice. Can I write a 10, 12 page paper instead? You know, where a student comes and asks you to do more work, they're probably not gaming the system. So there I thought it was a pretty, but again, that was physics. And initially that professor thought, this is, I do great papers, I'm a physics professor. But you know what, that wasn't a hard accommodation to make. And I think, again, we might see versions of that spin out from the experience of online and hybrid teaching as well.
Well, yeah, I imagine that students that your office works with or face a real anxiety that they might have when they're getting ready to graduate, whether their disabilities, their situations might interfere with them being able to get a job.
Absolutely. I think that that's part of our mission, in that we connect closely with career services to build the comfort in being able to transition to post-graduation pursuits. And that involves helping them decide how to talk to an employer about a disability, if and when to disclose, and how to approach accommodations in the workplace. We want them to understand a lot of pieces of self-advocacy in terms of talking about their strengths. And then we advocate for a strength-based approach in terms of talking to their employer. So if you ask for an employer, you're phrasing it or framing it in such a way that lets them know that this is going to build on your competence. This is going to allow you to be productive and contribute, as opposed to talking about your deficits or that your disability is causing you to be less than. So we really are aiming to strengthen our students' comfort again in their skills and being able to talk about that with employers at the next level.
So just that attitudinal change of not looking at it as just something that's strictly negative, that it opens up other possibilities. Do students, I imagine that's a question that a lot of people have. If you have a disability, either one that's short-term or situational or long-term, are you required to tell a potential employer?
No, you're not required. An employer is required to offer you the opportunity to disclose at different times throughout the employment process. And they certainly should make accommodations available to you for the interview process, for example. But it's totally up to a potential employee to decide if and when to disclose.
I imagine, though, that could be kind of a tricky situation, though, because if you don't want to disclose something and then it's going to come up later in the course of your work, is that something that...
Yeah, it's absolutely tricky. And again, we get into the nature of hidden disabilities versus those that are readily apparent. So an individual who has an obvious disability, you know, that's going to show in the interview process, for example, or in the hiring process. But for the majority of those who have hidden disabilities, what we really want them to understand, and this goes for the same in academia, to not wait to fail what we say, wait to experience some kind of distress or crisis, whether it's in college or whether it's in the employment setting, because it's harder to remedy at that point in time. So we are really strong in pushing for a proactive approach to ask for things before they're needed. As soon as you recognize that there's some barrier, some need for accommodation, ask for it. Talk to your employer, talk to your disability specialist at our office, whatever it might be, to make sure that you are prepared for the challenges that might come, rather than, again, waiting until you're in some kind of crisis.
So we have just a couple minutes left. I'm going to ask you both this question. So it's been 30 years since the passage of the ADA, and people, I think it's fair to say people are more accepting of differences now than then. But what do you think still needs to happen? What continue to be the barriers?
That's a great question. I think that ableism still exists. So I think we still appraise a person's worth based on how their body or mind functions. regardless of where we are right now, how 30 years removed from the ADA, I think we've come a long way in terms of physical barrier removal, like we've already talked about during our time together, but we still have a heck of a long way to go in terms of how we help attitudinal barriers or change attitudinal barriers and embrace hidden disabilities. We consider that hidden diversity. And we really always want to make sure that people recognize, again, I said it already, that disability is absolutely a part of the human experience. And that disability is absolutely a part of the diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation. Unfortunately, sometimes disability gets left out of that, which is why Michael and I are so excited about this new Disability Access Initiative working group, because it feels like a long time coming. So how can we move past the notion that people are less than because maybe they operate a little bit differently, that everybody is bringing something to the table, and that don't presume incompetence when you hear the word disability, that they absolutely are a person first and have something to, very positive to contribute. And I think that's what our office is trying to focus on.
Michael, any thoughts about what still needs to happen?
Well, we're going to go back to what did happen. I think I go back 25 years to a conversation I had with someone, wheelchair user, who's interviewing me on the radio. You wouldn't know it was on the radio. And it was in Chicago. And this is, you know, it's Chicago. It's horrible winters, right? And he was at the bus stop and he heard one woman say to another, "I don't see why we're doing all these curb cuts and kneeling buses. There aren't that many people it affects." And he has to say, "You don't see us because we don't have these accommodations." That, I think, has changed immeasurably. It's also changed in the K-12 system, where it's not at all unusual to have peers with special needs in your third grade classroom. So those changes are enormous simply because it brought people with disabilities into the mainstream, into visibility, where, as Leah says, now a lot of people understand it. It's part of the ordinary fabric of human life. It's part of the ordinary human variety. It's not stigmatized. It's not feared, and it's not something horrifying or strange. But to go back to something I said earlier, employment for people with intellectual and psychosocial disabilities is, I think, the next great civil rights struggle. I wrote a little bit about this in my follow-up book about Jamie called Life as Jamie Knows It, in which I talk about his work at the sheltered workshops. And the sheltered workshops, sooner or later, will close. They're, you know, sub-minimum wage, segregated workplaces. So there's a bipartisan support for getting rid of them. And they have to be phased out because the question is, if we close those workshops, where do those people go? And what kind of incentives can we offer employers to train and hire them? And we don't have a really organized national initiative to provide employers with the kinds of incentives they would need to employ people with intellectual or psychosocial disabilities.
Leah Zimmerman and Michael Barabay, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been talking with Leah Zimmerman and Michael Barabay about the 30-year anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. To listen to this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.